Episode 13 of Season 17. I'm Lyle Troxell, and today's show...
Open.gov calls BS on 30-year-old Whopper AI.
Starts right now.
We're through being cool. We're through being cool. Eliminate the ninnies and the twits.
Welcome to Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell, and in the air with me is Mr. Miles Elam. Miles is a programmer and pedant and a curmudgeon. He lives in Felton, California, and raises goats, chickens, and children. Hi, Miles.
How's it going?
Good. We also have Mr. Brian Young. He is also a programmer. He is not a pedant. He's also an artist, graphic designer, visual programmer, a father of two, and lives in Boulder Creek, California.
Hey, Lyle. Good to see you.
Good to see you as well. Do you consider yourself an artist?
Yeah, I do. I still put that up there.
You do?
That's good.
I think of you that way too.
And it always frustrates me when people think that they're not artists, because the only difference between an artist and somebody who's not is somebody that tries.
A self-proclaimed artist. Yes. But we're not talking about art today. Today we're going to talk about cell phones, and today we're going to talk about government and politics as relates to technology, and we're going to talk a little bit about the polarization of technology politically. But first, let's do some follow-up from earlier this year.
This was back in January 18th, we covered a class that two professors in the University of Washington had published information about so that they could teach it, and the classes have begun. Okay, so help me out here, because last time you had to shut me down and say I couldn't say the full title. So the title of their class is Calling BS in the Age of Big Data.
That's appropriate.
That's appropriate? Yeah. So they don't censor themselves. In fact, it's a pretty open discussion. And I got to watch a good 30 minutes of their class. And I really got to say, if you are interested in the topic of trying to figure out what is worth putting any weight to, trying to figure out if something is quality information or
just information you find online in any source, how do you validate and understand whether it's valid and true?
Exactly. Anything a politician says, anything that you read on the internet, anything you read in a tweet. This whole class is about trying to help people out on how to think and how to identify specifically people who are trying to BS you. And they give a whole definition of what they consider BSing, but essentially it is somebody who is trying to convince you of something or trying to impress you without any regard for the truth, logical consequence, or information that's being conveyed.
Is it just shoving liberal media down your throat with PolitiFact and Snopes and all sorts of other communist organizations?
Oh, no, no, no. This is about thinking, not about politics. In fact, one of the first charts they show is a Apple graph that Tim Cook would show regularly about, look, iPhone sales are great. They're going up exponentially. But it was a cumulative chart, not a chart of what monthly sales or annual sales would be.
Right.
So it's a really good class. I've gotten to look over the syllabus, which is published online, but take a look at it, and the videos are really they're really good.
They're relatively short as well. They're only 8 or 10 minutes apiece.
They're obviously editing things out of the full class. I don't know whether this lecture is intended to be an hour long or 2 hours.
But they
try to be a little funny. They don't always succeed, but it's definitely good information.
Thank you. You also have a story on T-Mobile, which will start our whole cell phone discussion chunk today. What did T-Mobile recently do?
Okay, so the – I always mess up the FTC or FCC?
FTC is Federal Communications.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The FCC had another auction to auction off radio spectrum. And, of course, this has been going on a lot. Over the last 20 years since we've been decommissioning the television radio waves and using digital transmission that doesn't use as much of a spectrum, and they've been opening this up to other devices like cell phones. So T-Mobile won in the auction 45% of the spectrum that was up for sale. Mm-hmm. This is a huge chunk, and quite a bit of it for T-Mobile is in the 600 megahertz spectrum.
Is that being used right now at all, that area?
No. This has been available since decommissioning analog television.
Okay.
And this is going to be a big boon for T-Mobile, especially in rural areas, because this spectrum is the kind of spectrum that goes through walls, through people, through trees, and will get further out in rural areas as well as into dense city areas. And this is going to help T-Mobile out, because I would love to have them at my house, and they stop 5 miles away from me inside town.
I noticed a Sprint ad recently that mentioned that, oh, all the networks are relatively the same, about 5% similar. And really, you want, and then they promoted their other stuff that they were selling. I thought, oh, that's interesting. That's a real big change to the competition's not as much about cell coverage. It's about feature set at this point. Except I'm thinking, well, except for in our area, in the San Jose Valley, where there are a lot of pockets for different carriers.
And we drive up to Oregon every summer, and I know pretty well where all of the bad spots are.
Because that's where you get a flat tire. Can't call anybody.
No, that's on top of Skyline. As far as T-Mobile goes, I've never been able to consider it as much as I've wanted to when they've had various really cool features or really cool programs that I would love to take advantage of, lower my bill. It's just not going to work in my area because I need that minimal connection that I have out where my house is.
Yeah. And Miles, thank you very much, Brian. Miles, you also have some cell phone history information for us.
Yes. The cell phone, or at least the commercial cell phone, is 30 years old as of 2 days ago.
30 years old cell phone. That was like the Eastern Bloc phone, right?
Big phone, yes. And went on sale 30 years ago today for $4,000.
Wow.
Hey, that was like the price of a Mac Plus, wasn't it?
That's interesting. That's about four times.
Motorola.
It's about four times as much as the phone I carry in my pocket. I have a very expensive phone. that's an expensive phone. And I'm assuming that was different than a car phone because it didn't have like a secondary big base. It was completely a handheld device without
right.
A
although
cable
the battery did not last anywhere near as long as modern cell
no,
phones.
No, of course not. And you also couldn't browse the internet.
All right. You had a simple LED screen. You know, the types that just had the
the cells. They're called 8-bit eight cells, LCD. Yeah.
8-bit or 8-cell.
Oh, yeah, 8-cell?
8-line, whatever.
Man, I used to use these things
all
the time.
Yeah, I used to.
It's a liquid crystal display, and it only has a certain amount of cells, right? So it's imagine the number 8 and break that into straight lines. They're called 7-segment displays.
Thank you.
I figured it out. Backwards engineered my brain.
Were they always red lights or?
No, I mean the one that you're talking about wasn't red light, right?
This was yeah, it probably. Is.
Oh, it is?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. So really early stuff, yeah. So that's actually a 7-segment LED display.
Yeah, I was about to say, there were LEDs, not an LCD.
Yeah. The LCD, of course, give you more options, but of course you have to backlight as well. So there's two different sources going on there. Interesting. Thank you for that.
So the radiation that thing could put off, was that hazardous?
I can't speak to that.
It was an
analog signal rather than the digital signals that we have today. And yes, the output was much higher than they are today.
Right, completely analog cell phone.
But they were not high enough frequencies that it would be ionizing radiation.
You know,
so
to say that it's analog, I mean, all broadcast is analog at some point, right?
Yes. Every once in a while, you have to hit the real world, and the real world is analog, not digital. However, the encoding on
but
there.
Those phones, you could definitely, a few feet away from it, you could pull out another device and listen in on the conversation. There was no, like, encryption or anything.
And when you talked with someone else, if you started going out of coverage area, you got static.
Right.
On the conversation. You still heard the person, but there was a lot of static, as opposed to modern cell phones, which the voice just cut out because you don't
very
get
well
the information.
Done. Very well done, sir.
And you drop the call.
Yeah. All right. Thanks. 30-year cell phones. Fantastic. What is the FCC planning on doing right now? Brian, thank you, Miles. Brian, what is the FCC chairman planning on doing now?
Okay. So new chairman in the FCC. And he's going through all the programs and rules and things that are going on. Back in 2013, the then chairman had decided to start a investigation and researching whether it would be possible to allow passengers on airlines to make direct connections to the cell towers below.
Meaning be on their cell phone.
Be on their cell phone. Not just using Wi-Fi, which we can do now, which was opened up in the last... When did that happen?
I don't know.
Yeah,
last few years.
Yeah, the last few years. But this was actually making a mobile connection to a cell tower below.
It's not a very efficient use of cell tech. Because when you're traveling at that speed and that distance, you're going to not have very good connections to cell phone towers.
And that was one of the things they had to research, because if you're going to hop towers that quickly at, 500 miles an hour or something like that?
It's definitely not an easy solution. Of course, when you're at low altitude, on the runway, all those times, it kind of makes it's not that big a deal. But as you get the full speed and the cruising velocity. It's also a long ways away for a cell phone tower.
And, of course, the concern has always been stated that these radios can interfere with instrumentation of the plane and be dangerous for pilots.
And that's what they're really researching, right?
Well, no. Actually, from what I remember hearing 5 years ago, a lot of what they were researching is whether the cell system could handle it.
Oh. Because everyone knows the plane. If the plane's going to be damaged by someone opening their cell phone up, we have a problem.
Well, everybody knows somebody, probably themselves, that has left their phone on at some time.
And they didn't die.
Yeah, exactly. So there's lots of people that have lots of theories on whether it worked. But we're not going to find out. The research has been canned.
Why?
It's Ajit Pai, the current chairman, is shutting that down because he says that people can use their devices on flights through Wi-Fi, and there is no need to continue investigating cellular service.
Interesting. Because, of course, if you're doing it through the Wi-Fi, then you're paying an extra fee to the plane company and the telcos that are supporting the plane company's cellular connection.
Well, you'd be doing that either way. If you had a cell phone, you're doing it inside the plane, they have the equivalent of a cell tower on the plane itself that relays.
Well,
there's no way that terrestrial cell towers are going to handle that Doppler effect from 30,000 feet.
That's what I'm thinking as well. Yeah.
So there is a cynical view to this, which is that this proposal to research this was very much opposed by flight attendants, airlines, consumer groups, pilots, and it could just be a corporate industry response that they would like to shut down.
Well, I mean, do you really need the cell phone to work on the phone?
No, but this is something that, you know, it strikes the public.
Yeah.
They want to be able to play with their devices where they want to play with them.
I like the idea of using my cell phone on a plane, but I definitely don't want everybody using their cell phone on the plane. I mean, silently, fine, but phone conversations? I mean, I'm in a shuttle with like 8 people going over the hill, and if someone's having a phone conversation, it feels kind of inappropriate. I had a call today, and I'm like whispering on the phone because I don't want to be disturbing people.
And if someone says, it's an emergency, I have to get that phone call.
Oh, yeah.
When you're on the plane, what are you going to do?
Pay for the credit card thing?
But that's the thing, though. Like, if it's so important to have a cell phone. That's what I'm wondering now with the hypothetical. You get on the plane, you're up in the air 30 minutes, and you've got 5 hours ahead of you. If you were able to get that phone call of some emergency, something that was going on, what could you do about it?
I could help my grandmother with her tech support problems for hours on end. I know what you're saying, like, couldn't – whatever emergency, it's not like you can do anything.
No one else could do. Yeah.
Right. I guess just sharing knowledge or, like, what if you're, like, desperately in love? You know that early stage of love where it's, like, painful to be separated? What about that aspect?
Oh, yeah. I want to listen to that on my –
Or you're late on the flight and your daughter's getting off stage in a school play and you want to tell her how wonderful she is. You know, that kind of thing. No,
everything's better through text messages where
definitely
everybody understands each other perfectly well.
other lawmakers, I guess the FCC chairman is actually not a lawmaker, but...
Yep, he's appointed, not elected.
Appointed, yeah, but there are lawmakers also making decisions about the internets.
Yes, Senator Sensenbrenner of Wisconsin has got some hackles up around the country where... In response to the call to reduce privacy, in other words, allow ISPs to look at the browsing activity, collect that for individual customers in as much as they can. His response at a town hall meeting seemed extremely tone deaf in that he was not just parroting the line from the FCC chairman saying that, well, there's tons of competition in the ISP space. If you don't like it, then you can go to someplace else, which is patently false.
Right. And we say that because, of course, the locations we are, there's basically one ISP, and that's the Comcast
system.
Yeah,
and that's a very common thing around the country.
And there's the broken DSL thing provided by phone service, which is just not as good enough speed. Mm-hmm. So not a lot of competition where we are.
His response was... You don't, and nobody's got to use the internet.
It's true. You don't have to get on the internet. I mean, I can get by in life just fine with water and food and a roof over my head.
And, you know, in California, you don't really need a roof over your head. You can live outdoors.
That actually
and you don't
true.
Actually need to be literate, right? Like, you don't need to be able to read because you can probably get a job and do things like that don't require you to read.
Yeah.
These are the same kind of arguments, right?
And to be an active citizen engaged in your community, you don't need to have the understanding that might be available through communication like the internet.
And, of course, if you want to drive and you want to learn how to drive, you wouldn't want to be able to get the resources online or even pay your license fees online. Or if you want to find out where your polling place is. I mean, there are so many things
or
now.
Or if you want to bank and not get some fees. Some banks will charge you fees if you go in as opposed to if you use their online app.
As much as we like the idea because we all of us as adults remember the world without the internet, at this point, not having the internet is a crippling type of thing, equivalent to not having other ability, like not having transportation, not having communication in general. The internet's become a fundamental need in our society. Not that we would die without it, but it makes living in the society without it very difficult.
Yeah. Aside from any questions of ageism with regard to senators, Sensenbrenner being on the high end, there's also that aspect of if you are a sitting senator, you get to dictate how your office runs, which means that if you don't want to use email, you don't have to. If you don't want to be online and make information available online or to tweet, you don't have to. And it's a position of privilege that most Americans don't have.
Right.
That idea to say, you know what, I don't feel like getting online to find that job that's going to pay me a wage to pay my mortgage.
Right. I mean, you can think of it this way, that if you're wealthy enough, you don't have to ever learn how to drive because you can always have people drive for you. Right. Yeah. But most of us are have to get to work or have to get to college, and we need a vehicle to do that or at least some way of transportation. Yeah. Interesting.
So this would go very much in the realm of we don't agree with him.
Right.
Yeah. So I come from a conservative background and I have an idea of where he's coming from. But what I just don't get is where this understanding of how a society is supposed to be strong and engaged with its citizenry if you don't think communication is key to that.
Yeah, that's true.
Speaking as a side note, a national park just recently, just a couple weeks ago, and completely out of cell phone range. And I had to make a phone call. In fact, I was going to make a phone call to you, Lyle. I needed to know when I needed to be back for that show so my daughter could go with you all. Mm-hmm. And I went to the payphone because there was a payphone there. I thought, this is awesome.
I
found a payphone. And I went up to it, and I didn't have any change. So I went inside the office to get some money. And she said, oh, I'm sorry, it doesn't take coins. You have to use a phone card. You have to use a prepaid phone card. And we don't sell those there.
Wait, so there's a cell phone, there's a phone outdoors, payphone outdoors that didn't allow you to take payments.
Right, there was no way for me to give a payment.
Payments. You had to get prepaid payments to use it.
And if I had internet, I could use my cell phone to go ahead and make a connection to buy a phone card.
That's great. So you weren't able to use it.
This is how far we've come. 20 years of internet and cell phones, and I can't use a payphone anymore.
I was just talking to the kids about coins and how I don't really use coins. And we were kind of joking about that. And I said, well, I used to always carry 2 dimes with me. And as I said this, I realized that it didn't make any sense at all. Anyway.
Yeah. The last time I saw a payphone, honestly, was when I was walking through downtown Oakland literally decades ago.
Was the handset still attached to it?
Well, that's the funny thing is that I stopped at one particular liquor store and was saying, hey, can I use the phone? And it was a bad neighborhood. He kind of looked at me a little shell-shocked and looked across the way and pointed and said, no, they took it. And there's a stump with wires coming out of the ground. And, you know, at that point, as we started moving towards cell phones soon after that, you know, what's the incentive for phone companies to go, yeah, we're going to put that back in?
Early days of this program, I remember going, gosh, you know, at some point there probably won't be mobile phones, you know, or maybe, sorry, there won't be pay phones. And sure enough, we've seen it. So you saw one, but you couldn't use it.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
It looked like it did in the 80s, too.
Yeah, I'm sure it hasn't been used much at all.
Yeah, so when did each of you transition over to cell phone? And when did you transition over, if you have already, to not have a landline?
Cell phone, 2002, and landline, 2003.
So before I met you, Miles, I had a mobile phone because the company I worked for was in the .com era was JFax, which was a telco company. And so we all got mobile phones for being on call. And I got that and started using it pretty regularly. So I guess it was 98?
Yeah, I think it was 98 for me as well. Yeah.
And then landline, I didn't get a landline, I think 9 years ago when I moved, or 8 years ago when I moved to the property I'm currently at, I let go of the landline. You?
I had landline with DSL service. I guess I got it again with DSL service when I moved back to Santa Cruz. 2002, 2003 is when I dropped the landline finally, yeah. I think.
My kids don't remember a landline, really.
Yeah. What do they do when they need to call an emergency number?
We leave a phone with them. You know, we'll always leave a phone. Also, they all have Hangouts and such, and only my youngest daughter doesn't have a phone, and we're about to get her one. So my older kids have phones. So pretty soon, they all have phones. The thing that's frustrating is when my wife puts her phone somewhere, like in the car, and then it's in the house, and I can't reach her. So what I've ended up doing now is I can get the Amazon cylinder device to play music and stuff. So in the past, what I've done is I just turn – because remotely from my phone, I can cause it to play music. So I just turn the volume up to 10, which is really loud, and I play some Metallica song. It's been really loud. And then that was scaring her, but also it takes a second to figure it out. And then finally I was like, oh, no, I can play the Geekspeak podcast really, really loud on that thing. So anytime she all of a sudden hears – this is episode blah, blah, blah. It's Lyle Troxell in the kitchen. She'll go, oh, Lyle's trying to reach me. And then she'll call me.
That's so much nicer than what I do.
What do you do?
Find my iPhone. That
and you just go, horrible, bling, bling, bling.
No, it's a horrible screech.
Yes. Find my iPhone, I guess, would be a good one, too. Let's move on to, actually, we've kind of been touching upon this because we talked about some political stories. And we're in a very politicized time. But you've got a whole paper about internet and polarization of politics.
Okay, so since probably last summer, there's been a lot of talk about everything from fake news to how we become more polarized to what can you trust on the internet. And then, of course, there's all the sharing through social media. So throughout all of this, all the discussion I've heard, the assumption has been that the internet is, that the rise of the internet and the rise of social media is really the cause for this polarization where people just are not believing the same facts anymore. People just don't read
the bubbles, these social bubbles and these internet bubbles that people are talking about.
Exactly.
Right? Okay.
Yeah, the social media bubbles. So there haven't been papers on this that I've seen until just recently. And this particular paper was published only a couple weeks ago. And it is exactly on the subject. They tried to look at 9 different attributes to figure out, are we more polarized and is it because of the media? Or I'm sorry, because of social media on the internet.
How would you go about trying to figure that out, considering it's hard to know? I mean, I guess you could do like Gallup polls in the past and Gallup in current day and then go compare them. But of course, that might not be directly associated with the internet. It might just be that we're more political. We're more polarized now. It might not be a so. How would you connect
well, first of all,
it's like there are entire fields of study in universities that try to deal with this problem.
So first of all, one thing they cite as giving a explanation that we are more polarized is that there are a couple different surveys. One in 1960, which asked, "Do you feel displeased if your son or daughter married outside their political party?" And 5% of both Republicans and Democrats said yes. Okay. So 2010, a different question, but related, was asked, do you feel somewhat or very unhappy at the prospect of inter-party marriage? So 30% of Democrats actually said yes to that, and 50% of Republicans said yes.
That's a lot larger than 5%.
Yeah, both groups had a stronger reaction.
Okay. And I think that makes sense to some degree. I recall, as a in my youth, political parties being interesting, and we could talk about it and debate. You know, my uncle was Republican; we all knew that, and the rest of the family was Democrat, and we'd be able to chat about things. But there was never like a schism in that sense. It was just like the political opinion. You know, there's one way of thinking about how to govern a society versus another, and how, you know, the motions, all the steps were slightly different with a different philosophy behind them, but they were all respectful. I don't think that's the same right now at all. I think there's a lot of distrust and hatred of the other side, this feeling that they're against you. And that's definitely feels like a newer thing.
It's definitely an us and us versus them kind of sense going on. So that's where we start.
So that shows a baseline of there is more polarization.
Right.
So how do they connect that to the internet, though? That's the question.
So they had a number of sources. And what they did was they tried to look at 9 different questions that would show polarization. And I'm going to skip to the end real quick here and say that what they summed up is it's not a difference between people who are using the internet and not using the internet. They're not finding that that is the cause of polarization. In fact,
how did they survey people that weren't using the internet? Sorry.
they have sources. There is a 2012 time series study data set, 2008 time series study. I'm not sure what the time series is.
They can also...
They also have the primary source is the data from the American National Election Studies, ANES. It's a 1948 and 2012 cumulative series of surveys.
Right. And of course, the other aspect of this is you don't have to find people that don't use any internet and then people that do use internet and then ask them questions and see the difference. You can look at people that are on the internet a lot more than others, right? So the impact of me on from the internet versus, you know, my wife, for example, who spends less time on the internet, there might be a difference there, and you could correlate at that respect on how much time you are engaged in dialogue on the internet or reading stuff on the internet.
Yeah. So what do you think the biggest factor that they found was in trying to define who was more polarized than somebody else?
Education.
No.
Oh.
Although I wonder if there's a correlation there as well.
Miles probably said it earlier then. Age.
Yes.
Was it age?
Yeah. Speaking for Miles. Did you see that?
I
see the blank look on your
face. Well, he denoted that the politician that was possibly older and therefore not using as much internet and syncing, it's not important because in his life he has the privilege of not having to use it because other people use it for him. So in ages.
Yeah. So in 2012, which is the last year that they have data, 20% of people aged 75 and older were using social media. 80% of people aged 18 to 39 were using social media. So the biggest correlation they found was age. In fact, people who were using the internet more, using social media more, were less polarized.
Mm-hmm.
And they also found out that when they looked at the data, throughout throughout a year, an average Twitter user who followed at least one political account became slightly more moderate with exposure to political media.
Oh, interesting.
So that was determinable.
Okay. So they found people are using the Twitter and they were finding out who they were following. And if they were following a political person, they were more likely to be forgiving of political views?
Yeah, they were more likely to moderate their views.
Huh.
And one other interesting point is that high-speed internet access increased online news consumption but had no impact on political attitudes.
So a high speed versus a dial-up.
Yeah. So
Dial-up?
Well, high-speed versus – I mean,
versus
where's the
DSL.
Line? Okay.
Between plain old copper lines.
I don't know. The thing is, if you – as a person that works for a service that sends a lot of bits, right? At Netflix, we send a lot of data. When you have a slower internet connection, we still serve you the same content. It's just more pixelated, it's not as high quality.
Well, it's not the same content. It's bit rate is reduced.
Well, it's the same content as much as you get. If you were to describe it, you'd describe it the same way. It's not like we're giving you half how Orange is the New Black, right? We're giving you all of it. It just looks worse and maybe sounds worse, right? Not very much so. What I'm saying is that you are still going to get all the same type of content. You just won't get the same kind of quality. And if you're not used to the higher quality, you don't even really necessarily notice it. So I don't think that the versus a high speed line is going to make that much difference on what you consume on the internet.
Okay, you guys are totally off the track.
I mean,
the whole reason to bring up high speed versus some slower speed of getting your news is we know the whole rate of somebody who is trying to look at a web page. What is it? If the web page doesn't load within 2 seconds, two or 3 seconds, most people will leave it.
Oh, is that the new metric? It used to be 8 seconds.
No, it's 2 or 3 now.
The thing is, though, Brian, that is all based off of comparative experience. If you're doing reading of news and stuff on the internet right now, and you're trying to use a dial-up, it probably would be a horrible experience. But if you're using DSL versus a high-speed internet connection, and you're browsing the internet, the experience you're used to is it loading in 4 seconds. So 4 seconds is not going to be a barrier.
At the same time,
you can get the data faster and it's slow that it becomes an anomaly that you skip away from.
Well, at the same time, if you go over to somebody's house and you ask them, do they read news on the internet. Like, no, that's just not a good experience. I use the newspaper. It's
right.
It's immediate. Or they get it from Fox News, or
it's immediate. And as much as I can read it now, it was printed 4 days ago. But
it's a good caching mechanism.
That's true. Good caching mechanism.
So this paper is the first place that I've seen that argues that the internet and the openness of information the way it is now is not the cause of this polarization that we're seeing. They point to there's possibilities out there. There was an article that covered the same paper by by Ezra Klein. And she brought up that older Americans are more likely to be watching television and getting their news from television than they are from social media.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Do we see more polarization in the elderly than the youth? I mean, in that dynamic of usage of internet,
yeah.
Do you see a correlation?
Within this study,
yeah.
Looking at the study, those who were older were more polarized, and those who used the internet
more
and younger,
less
polarized.
Okay, got it. So that's why it's not associated with the internet. But what you're saying is it could very well be television.
Yeah, if you're looking for a factor, that's one possibility.
Well,
but this paper doesn't try to answer that question.
So anyone else find it humorous that the same generation that was so concerned that our generation would be corrupted by violent video games has been corrupted themselves by, you know, Fox News or
bad television.
Breitbart.com?
Or that we were sitting on the computer too long, not doing other things?
Yeah, that's kind of interesting.
Do you guys, how much TV a day do you guys watch?
I don't watch television. I watch Netflix.
Good answer.
And I'm paid to say that. Let's see. How much do I watch? I could look at my viewing history, but I think in the last like 5 days, I've probably watched maybe 2 hours of television a night, mostly after my family goes to sleep. And it's mostly YouTube videos about making things.
So, and you, Miles?
But not Netflix shows?
I do my Netflix shows mostly with the family. We mostly try to do, like, sit down together.
Oh, you're only talking about what you watch by yourself then, not in total.
Well, yeah, but I was thinking is how much Netflix have I watched? That was my first thought. But really, the family and I, you know, we all watched one show for 4 hours the other night. And that's all we've watched the last week together. And other than that, it's mostly YouTube videos because I kind of save the shows to share with other people. But, you know, that's not totally representational. But I do watch a lot of YouTube because I like instructional videos. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Miles, what about you?
Hard to say. Does it count when the TV is on, but you're concentrating on coding in front of you and just want background noise?
That's actually a really interesting question because what I was going to bring up is that when I go over to the grandparents' houses, when I go over to my parents' houses and my in-laws' houses, the TV is always on. In fact, it's constantly there.
And can't stand it.
In so many cases, we have to go and my wife and I turn the TV off just so we can concentrate because for our parents, it's a normal thing and they're used to that constant sound of it going on and they can carry on a conversation and we can't.
But having a background, I have an in-law as well that has Fox on all the time and news and I go over there and that's in the background. It's very distracting and also feels to set the tone of the room with a bit of an angst and fear. That's the tenor of the space is. So I'm always kind of turning it down. And finally, lately, whenever I go over there, I just turn it off. And she seems to forgive me for that, which is nice. But I don't think my kids do background viewing of any sort. When they're engaged in a screen, they are fully engaged in that screen.
Yeah, my kids cannot walk into a room with a screen that's playing any sort of video without being completely captured by it.
My daughter actually will start to watch it, and then she'll go and start doing other things. She'll notice when it's turned off and then talk about how it's her turn and she needs to have it on again. But she'll play happily by herself or with friends with the TV on, paying no attention to it.
My son will watch Netflix. As we watch as a family, we watch a show together as a family. He'll also be on his phone doing a feed as well, reading through something. Texting with people.
Teenage multitasking.
Yeah, really bad habit. But then again, I've got to let him be an individual at some point, right?
He's got to make his own mistakes.
Hey, you're listening to Geek Speak on KBCZ, Boulder Creek Community Radio Station. I'm Lyle Troxell, and I'm speaking with Miles Elam and Brian Young. In a minute, we're going to talk more about actually the Trump administration killing something bad. And then we're going to get all into fun stuff of like Burger King and AI and AI's artificial intelligence, pixelization and text, all those things we're going to cover in a little bit.
Pixelization?
Yeah, you'll get to it in a second. You can, of course, learn more about what we talk about at geekspeak.org. And all the stuff we talk about, we have links and other content for. And, of course, you can also learn more about our program and subscribe to our podcast if you would care to do so. Okay, Mr. Miles Elam, what's up with the Trump administration with regards to, I don't know, something related to technology?
Do you remember the website open.gov?
Yes, it had all this great data that you could download and have access to.
Well, there's data.gov. That was another thing. That was the census information, various studies and stuff like that. But open.gov also had information related to, for example, what's the White House visitors list?
So this was part of the Obama administration's initiative to make government both more digital and make the information more readily available to the public?
Yes. I do have to, in fairness, say that Obama has a very mixed record with regard to transparency. In fact, he's been fairly poor, and any transparency that was there had to be
vetted or pushed
for. Well, had to be, yeah.
Yeah, he made a lot of promises in his running up to election, and then when the follow-through happened, he didn't say yes as much as the people that wanted that OpenGov to exist would like.
Right. But it did exist, and this actually follows a 2013 ruling that said that the original case was actually during the Bush administration, even earlier, that they didn't have to show the visitor logs as part of a Freedom of Information Act. It was part of the official government record for posterity, but it wasn't something that you could just request at a moment's notice. Open.gov changed things a bit that you could know what the visitor log was going to say.
And the visitor log is just an example of this, right? It's not. This would be at all levels of government. Or are we just talking about the visitor log of the White House?
We're talking about the White House.
Just that.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, when you're talking about the administration, the executive branch, that's all they have control over. They don't have control over Congress or the like. This is just talking about the executive. But open.gov is no more. Trump is dumping it and is very specifically stating that he's not going to have the visitor logs open. And it's a shame because it feels like a step in the wrong direction that the Obama administration was not good at transparency, but there were a few little leaks, a few things that showed some promise.
Does it matter too much to you that we no longer know who visits the White House?
It does, actually.
Why?
It matters because, as Princeton and other studies or other universities have shown in their studies, the political process, to a large extent, tends toward the oligopoly. You have a lot of push from the most wealthy to get legislation through, but not so much initiatives that the wealthy are against, even if there is popular support for it. And the visitor logs are an easy way to get a window into what are the moves that are being made.
Yeah. Who has the ear of the administration?
So this is kind of a shortcut for campaign finance reform. If you can't know how much money people are giving, you can at least know who is having access to influence.
Right. At least know to be able to say, okay, we're going to, you know, either put up support or we're going to fall back and not do it. Because you know who is coming in, what type of person, what their record is like, you can a lot of times gather what the political strategy is going to be.
Mm-hmm. Of course, that's just the administration, right? That's not – I mean, that's one little arm of the government.
Sorry?
Well, you were – and this is – I mean,
Branch, yeah. Yes. The executive branch does set policy even if it doesn't pass legislation.
Sure, sure. Well, okay, I didn't know about OpenGov in that sense. I thought of it as a broader movement than just the transparency of the White House.
Well, data.gov is not doing so well either, but that's for another show.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for that depressing news. well, let's go ahead and – let's see. I lost my place. Miles, you actually – well, then we'll go ahead and go to artificial intelligence. We haven't talked about artificial intelligence for, I don't know, at least an episode.
Oh, you didn't want to go from our president to the king?
No. The Burger King? We will talk about Burger King in just a second.
Okay. Artificial
it's
intelligence.
It's a whopper of a story. Stay tuned.
Oh, God.
Okay. So artificial intelligence, machine learning, all of this is becoming a huge topic lately. We've got a whole number of technologies that are starting to draw from artificial intelligence. And I found this great Medium post that talks about trying to tease out for basically the cocktail party kind of conversation what these things are, trying to allow people who are mere mortals to be able to talk a little bit about AI and machine learning and know enough about what they're talking about that they can carry on an intelligible conversation. So this article is right at that level, and this person is going through the process of learning about artificial intelligence themselves as a developer, and they wanted to be able to explain this before they lost that noob's perspective.
Can I read that first question? And we can actually go through it?
Yeah.
Okay, so the first question in this article is, what are the differences between artificial intelligence, machine learning, neural networks, and deep learning? And that's great because the answer starts talking about how they all feel they're all different, which I know they're all different, but they also all get used interchangeably, which is true. Like, yeah, as you're talking about neural nets, then you start talking about deep learning, even though it's really a different kind of pattern, but it's very connected. In fact, I don't even know the difference between deep learning and neural networks. Do you know the difference, Miles? I thought that deep learning was a large neural net of neural nets, if you will.
Well, I'm not going to comment.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, another way to express that is it's not just a single neural net, but a neural net with layers representing multiple facets of the data set.
Here's the answer in the article. Deep learning refers to a class of neural networks. It has a specific technical meaning, but has also become a buzzword for the deep part. Just means that the network architecture has multiple layers, three layers deep versus one layer shallow. And the outcome of that is that the deep networks can learn and reason much more effectively than one layer networks. That kind of makes sense.
Yeah. So that's neural networks and deep
deep learning.
Deep learning. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I'm looking at so many terms right now. I'm forgetting it.
Sure.
So, but if you step back a little bit broader term would be machine learning. Now, she does a really good, interesting thing here because she talks about how we talk about machine learning a lot like teaching a child and how it can resemble teaching a child. And we give lots of data, lots of examples to this child, and they give feedback on whether the system gets feedback on whether it's right or wrong. And that sounds a lot like how we teach our kids. But
yeah. And that's why it's called machine learning, right? It's the idea is that you're kind of training it as you go so it gets better by learning.
But she likens it more to teaching a dog.
Yeah.
And this is where it gets really interesting because a child's actually learning how to think as well as what to think.
Right. And they might be having a sub-thought about what you're trying to teach them. Like there might be other things going on that's hard to understand.
Yeah, I do have issue when you say teaching just because – a lot of times when we're talking about machine learning, it's a fancy term applying statistics to computer programs.
Right. And so, it's much more training.
Yeah, when you say statistics, you know, people go like, oh, okay, statistics, machine learning. Ooh, let me get my pocketbook. Here, take my money. And and so when you have that notion of it's just, or I don't want to say just, because it is an emerging field, but it's just statistics, and so you don't treat it as someone is learning. You give it data sets, and does it give the output that you want? Oh, it's not. Let's put in more data that's going to skew that algorithm to get the data that you want.
So her point about teaching a dog speaks exactly to this, and she says that when you teach a dog, you have it sniff out, or if you're trying to make it sniff out a bomb, if you're trying to do lots of training, you give it something to do, and if it does it right, you give it a treat, and if it doesn't do it right, you don't give it that treat. You're giving it input, but in no way do you think that dog understands what a bomb is or what these different things are. In fact, you don't understand how the dog can figure out whether that's a bomb or whether it's something else. It becomes a bit of a black box in that sense. You're giving input, you're telling it what's right and wrong, and from there it can start to distinguish it without you knowing how that's happening.
Mm-hmm. The training that our dog is called Higgs boson. That's our dog's name. And one of the things
geek,
we use quite a bit for Higgs is to get him out of the kitchen when we're dining room, but it's we just eat in the kitchen. So out of the kitchen when we're eating. Now, he'll come into the kitchen and kind of walk in and kind of sniff around. And then I say, Higgs, living room, which is the room adjacent to the room we're in. And he will, when I say that to him clearly enough, he will very much go into the room and sit down at the barrier of the room. And I understand that that's what he's doing. Of course, I can also just say room. The kids have now understood that the key word he's actually getting is not living room. He's just getting room. For some reason, that works. And if you say living and you look at him, it doesn't work. So it's definitely the room word, right? Even though we trade him with the full word. But the other thing is you can be outside or a different space or at someone else's different house, and you can say living room to him, and all he does is walks away from you. He'll just leave your immediate area and kind of get a little ways farther away. He won't go look for a threshold that has carpet, right? He just kind of walks away from you. So it has no meaning to where he goes. That's nothing about it.
He's looking for a behavior that will get him what he wants.
Right. He knows that I'm acknowledging something about him. And normally if he goes and does this thing, he'll get a treat. You know, sometimes he'll get the treat. So great. Training.
So what you're saying is your dog is failing the Turing test?
Oh, he has failed the Turing test. It's so easy to defeat him. You're not intelligent.
So if you want to take a look at this article, we will post it up on our website on GeekSpeak. But the entire point of this was for her to be able to explain it to mere mortals so that we stop talking about in the sense of robots are coming to take our jobs.
That's a good point, that they're really... It's different than that.
What she's trying to make the point of is computers are already better at this kind of recognition than we are as humans. Now, we're still the better pattern matchers in general, but as far as machine learning goes, computers can now do things that we can't.
And with deep learning,
yes,
they're getting much better at pattern recognition. Image pattern recognition for machines is much faster than us. We're more accurate, but they're faster. That's a little disturbing because for a long time it was things like, you know, adding up a whole bunch of numbers was the, you know, you can add up 7,000 numbers or you can use Excel to add up 7,000 numbers. And I'd like to do the latter, you know, it'd be a lot more interesting. But when you're talking about like describing a photograph, in some ways machine learning is more consistent. Machine learning systems that do image categorization is more consistent than human beings because I might say that's a glass and Miles might say that's a cup, but the machine will pretty much every time be able to say that is made of that's a thing that holds liquids and it is a cylinder and it is, you know, glass. Like they have all these other terms they can associate because of its pattern matching skills. So it's a little disturbing how fast that's going in the sense that it felt like that used to be a quality that we had and machines didn't have. And I think that's where some of the concern has about machine learning.
Especially with regard to white collar automation. Whereas before, it's mostly been blue collar automation.
By the way, the description of artificial intelligence, I think this is really good. Artificial intelligence is the umbrella term for the entire field of programming computers to solve problems. Which is funny, because of course, I program computers to solve problems. In fact, everyone that programs computers is solving problems. Unless, of course, they're an artist and they just want to make it whine or whistle or whatever. I would distinguish this from software engineering. This is also the article still. Where the program computes to perform. Computers to perform tasks. AI can be used to solve broadly as to be almost meaningless, in part because the scope of the phrase is constantly evolving. It's kind of valid. Thanks.
Sounds kind of hand wavy to me, but okay.
It has to be because it's a complicated barrier. Like, where does that, you know, is your calculator an AI? Well, yeah, your calculator is a very focused AI that does really good at math.
I don't consider it AI at all.
Where's the line? The deep learning system that matches photos and can tell you if there's a, you know, Higgs is in the picture or not, that's just a complicated calculator.
I was about to say because I put in numbers, but I guess you could put in a wide variety of numbers. They all fit a very strict pattern. But then I started to think along spam filters. That was something that I would...
You'd call that AI?
That I would say is straddling that line very, very strongly. To say this is a pattern of email I've never seen before and this is unacceptable versus this being acceptable.
Miles, please do tell us about the whopper of a story that you have.
Yes.
Thanks, Brian, for the AI article. And if you want to read that article, you're welcome to go to geekspeak.org. We'll link to it from today's show, which, of course, is April 19th.
Yeah, better part of a week ago, Burger King decided, hey, I know, we don't have much time to have an ad, you know, you have that 30-second ad spot. So instead of talking about everything we would normally talk about in there, we're going to talk about just some pointed items and then say out loud, okay, Google.
Oh, I see. Yeah, yeah.
And apologies for anyone who...
So they did the trigger word for the Google Home device thing.
And so when the ad ended, that Google Home device started listing off data from Wikipedia about what a Whopper is, what it's comprised of. People started noticing this. And in addition to Google shutting it down, they thought it was a...
Not cool.
A misuse of resources. But also people started editing the Wikipedia page frantically. So they would start reading off various things.
They looked at a Wikipedia lookup. That's a bad idea.
Wikipedia has since locked down the article from edits.
Anytime a Wikipedia article gets edited too much, too quickly, it gets locked down to be protective of it. So were they adding ingredients to the Whopper that were not
They were having some fun. Google Home, or Google, changed the trigger for Google Home to not allow that ad to work. Burger King then decided it would be a good idea to change their ad so that the pitch was slightly different so that it would again trigger Google Home.
Wow.
Which Google then has also since pulled back.
Well, that's an interesting problem, though, because how do you decide what's appropriate and what's not appropriate to put in an ad? They're just putting audio in there.
Yeah. See, this is an area where I thought Google would have had been more than
prepared.
Well, more than justified, and it would have been funny if they had just hard-coded a really snarky response.
Now, anytime you ask about a Whopper, it just says, that is a horrible food, and a company that misuses technology, don't go there.
Or just like, I can't find anything about Whopper, but I do see something about Five Guys, In-N-Out, list of all the competitors.
I'd suggest going here and say, yeah, it's interesting that Google didn't do more than that. This problem, of course, is going to become more of an issue. I mean, in my home right now, if someone comes in, they can order food, or they can order anything they want on Amazon just by talking to it. And I don't have an ability, unless I'm there, I don't have an ability to turn off. And the device can work outside my house. So even if people don't have keys to my house, they can stand outside and start ordering things from me. So
excellent.
Why am I saying this on air? You have the Google Home
thing,
right?
Most people don't know where you live.
Present company excluded. Brian, you've got the Google Homey thing, right? Do you have it connected to a credit card at any source?
No. In fact,
so you're safe.
Yeah,
I was going to visit you.
I was thinking it is not a shopping machine unless you're talking about music, which I don't have that connected either.
I'm just wondering. There used to be practical jokes when we were younger of leaving feces in a bag at someone's front
and lighting on fire.
Yeah, or stuff like that. I'm wondering if there are any companies that sell on Amazon something that's akin to feces. And then, you know, or just, you know, fertilizer, something that's very stinky or something, it has something like that. And if I were to hypothetically go over to your house and order
I think the appropriate thing to order as a joke through somebody's Echo or something is like the Google Home one, right? You'd use the Echo to buy the Google Home one and be like, this isn't secure, get this one. That'd be kind of funny. Brian, you've got bad news.
This out of researchers in California, San Diego. They have been able to use AI to determine what is redacted through blurring or pixelation and posted on the internet.
Oh.
So you know all those movies where people are like, okay, zoom in, enhance,
yes.
Enhance. They're actually able to do it.
Well, kind of.
Kind of, yes. What they need to do is they have to determine what font, what typeface was likely used in order to use that model to determine what the characters are like.
And there's
underneath
some
that
level
blur.
Of blur or pixelization that would cause a failure. But they can get to some point where a human couldn't read it at all, but the AI could read it.
Oh, absolutely. And it's a pretty broad area.
Are there pictures from this article?
There are pictures in the
I'm
article.
Seeing
so in other words,
I can't tell
whether. See, the sample they have, the large one that says, sorry, but this doesn't work, I can read that. I mean, Miles, I shouldn't have told you what it was before, but you could read that, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
I can read
so
that.
The pixelization doesn't necessarily, it's not exactly that bad.
I was actually thinking we're doing more advanced blurring and trying to be more stylized and trying to trying to maintain the composition of the overall photograph in many cases, but blurring out that excess data. At the same time, were we in fact safer when all we were doing was taking that JPEG, loading it into Microsoft Paint, and drawing a big red box?
That was the way to go.
Well, that was kind of like in Hidden Figures. The main character holds the paper up to the light to be able to read what is redacted through
ink. With a Sharpie. Yeah.
And so the character just says, well, maybe we need darker ink. But no, it's pretty cool that they're able to do this. This is better than any brute force technique. They're actually able to use the information of what is in the settings and typeface to determine what must have been the text. And they're getting a very high rate of success with that. So if anybody decides that their information out on the internet is blurred enough, I'd blur it a little bit more.
I don't think you should post stuff that's blurred to assume that it's going to be okay. I mean, there's a long history of trying to redact information and having it not be good. I mean, old printed out papers that were marked out, you could also just throw different types of chemicals and the underlying material would emerge from the inked out stuff.
I love how this is just reverse steganography.
Instead of hiding stuff in plain sight.
Yeah, instead of hiding a message in there, you're trying to remove the message from it, and so you're trying to gain the message that was lost as opposed to...
Yeah, what fascinated me is in 2007, somebody was able to reverse engineer... You know that twirl effect that's in Photoshop and in Apple's image editing software? You can untwirl it and figure out what that information
image
was.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool. That's really cool. You also have a story about facial recognition login. I know there is facial recognition login. Who's doing
it? It's pretty common
on a phone or something?
It's pretty common on Android phones, and Microsoft has had their own version in Windows for years gone
by. So your phone is locked, and instead of typing in your keypad, you just hold up to your face, and it looks at your face and goes, hey, that looks like the person that owns this phone, and then it unlocks. Convenient as hell. How could you possibly defeat that?
No, of course. It's been talked about for a while in the last year and in all the sources I listen to that, you know, facial recognition is just not security. You can't use that to secure your devices.
But no one else has the face I have.
Yeah. So this is the cool part, though. There's many ways to defeat it, and people are making more and more advanced systems that are looking into depth or looking into motion cues to see whether it's your face. Because, you know, it's kind of hard to hold a still photograph up and make the still photograph blink. Or to smile.
Oh, you can defeat these with a photograph.
Well, that's how it started. So people were defeating these systems with a simple photograph, but the systems were looking at depth. They're looking at animated cues.
Or they're looking at how your face moves in relation to the camera, and if it slightly turns from left to right, well, obviously that's a three-dimensional image of your face.
Right. So these researchers went ahead, and previous researchers had used multiple photographs to build a 3D model of someone's face and then defeat the system with that. But, you know, that those photographs were supplied to the researchers. That's kind of cheating,
it's like,
right?
Hold still. I want to unlock your phone later, and you scan someone's head.
So the goal for these researchers was to go ahead and get publicly available photographs. And
pre-existing photos.
These are people that are all the subjects they were using were people that were already fairly security conscious. They weren't just posting every day on Twitter their photos for years on end. So between, with some subjects, it was as few as 3, with other subjects as much as 23 photographs. They were able to reconstruct a 3D model of that person's face. And once they have that 3D model, it's a simple process of animating either the eyes or a smile enough to defeat the system.
So they just took a composite of images that are like available somewhere of this person.
Yeah.
And then from that used AI to generate a 3D model of the person. And then, of course, took one of those photos, superimposed it, or skinned the 3D model, and then animated the 3D model. Yeah.
And if they had problems, they just used a different texture map from one of the other photographs to skin it, and that generally fixed the problem. Now, if you want to see this yourself, you can't use their research, but you can go out and use an app called 123 Catch by Adobe. It's an iOS app. And it allows you to take multiple photographs of any object, and it leads you to go around it. And by taking these photographs where the phone knows where in relation to the object it is, because the phones have the motion sensors and can determine where in the space they are, it can stitch together a 3D model from those photographs. It's really cool.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. This is GeekSpeak, and GeekSpeak is mostly Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, so you can use our stuff any way you'd like. Just give us credit. And the theme song today is by Devo, Through Being Cool. I'm Lyle Troxell, and in the air room, and thank you very much, gentlemen, for joining me, is Brian Young.
It's a great time. Thank you.
And Miles Elam.
Always a pleasure.
And Miles, do you have a title for today's show?
Open.gov calls BS on 30-year-old Whopper AI.
This is episode 13 of season 17. I'm Lyle Troxell. Thank you, Brian, and thank you, Miles, very much for joining me. All right, post-show love, gentlemen.
Oh, goodness, I've got like half my stories in the post-show.
We just have a whole list of things for you, but now, since we're talking about vision, let's go ahead and talk about optical illusions.
Okay, so we were talking about what AI can do and what AI is. This paper is all about what defeats AI, and you get some really interesting effects. So they're calling this optical illusions, but what this is are patterns that the facial recognition or the image recognition software can see that we don't. So to us, something that might look like noise or some rainbow pattern is able to completely fool the AI system into thinking that the object is something entirely different. So one of the examples they give is that by wearing some special glasses that have certain patterns and colors to them, they're able to make one person be recognized as somebody completely different. Can you see these photographs?
I'm looking at the photographs. That's really different.
Yeah, no. We're talking about a man who's not well-shaven, tall face, being recognized as a highly made-up woman with very narrow eyes, strong mascara that you would never mistake these two people.
No, there's no. So what you're saying is that we make two people look similar in our minds by cues of how we think about humans and such.
Right.
But the computer is making two images match together by mathematics. So if you can inject noise into that mathematic algorithm to modify what its view is, you can trick it just like we can get tricked by optical illusions. So they're computer optical illusions in
well,
some ways.
We talked about earlier how this is a machine learning where the computer is trained to recognize that they get various images in there.
Right.
And it through this process of being told that is something and that is not something, it builds up what features the system will use to determine what an object is in that black box.
Yeah.
Well, these researchers, if they had access to the source code of that system, were able to construct just something that would change the image enough that it would recognize it not as what you would expect it to, but as something completely different.
Wow, and the boxes of just patterns that repeat that represent words are great. There's a whole bunch of things like digital clock is just a whole bunch of red ovals in a black field. A soccer ball is a whole bunch of wavy lines with a green in the middle. Like really, like
well, okay,
in
that
no
one's
way,
interesting. That
in
one's
no
interesting.
Way it look like it's similar.
Yeah. You say in no way, but that soccer ball one, I can kind of make out. I can kind of see a pattern there that I can think, yeah, that's.
Oh, I see. It's the soccer ball rolling or moving or something. Yeah, okay.
Yeah but or
these are great.
Maybe it's a sphere that's been laid out and the pattern just is not in perspective.
Well, so what's going on here in these is that there are fragments of imagery that a computer, if it notes that, it has similarities to other things. So imagine like a screwdriver, for example, is a thicker part with a thin line. And so screwdrivers have that characteristic. So in this screwdriver image, it's just a whole bunch of thick parts with thin lines. And in that in way, it triggers enough of the pattern matching. Because of course, the neural nets are really about a whole bunch of different discrete blocks that have little tiny sub-pattern matchers, and then those all coming together to produce a whole, this is a high probability of that. And so when you show those segments in the photo anywhere, the system does trigger a whole bunch of high points and gets a match.
Yeah.
That's cool. It's really
so
cool.
This area of study is called adversarial machine learning, and it's really important because we expect autonomous cars and all sorts of other systems to be using machine learning or even the military using machine learning to drop bombs or
sure.
any other weapon. But if you understand these systems enough that you can trick it, all of a sudden your car is going to go careening off in the wrong place.
I'm disturbed by the assault rifle picture because it looks nothing like an assault rifle at all. And I would assume in a combat situation, being labeled as someone that has an assault rifle would be a problem. So this T-shirt could kind of give you a death sentence in some environments.
Exactly. I've got a great T-shirt for all of you all.
Man.
We're going to play Capture the Flag. You guys wear the T-shirts. So this kind of problem is considered a really important area of research, but it's very new. They're just trying to, develop this body of knowledge now. So why this happens, they've identified in most algorithms that do this machine learning is they've labeled it a boundary decision problem. So boundary decisions are that point at which the system has to determine, is this Lyle or is this Miles? And for humans, we probably have a larger area at which we say, I don't know. In fact, that's one of the solutions they're looking into, is making these machine learning algorithms less sure that it's Lyle or that it's Miles, and for them to determine that there's not enough to figure out who that is.
Right.
So this kind of stuff is going to be really important if it ever gets used for security.
Fascinating. And it's a Verge article. I highly recommend. I'm going to read it after the show.
Yeah, I want to bring up one more thing about it, which is in nature, animals also have the same decision boundary failure. It's called a supernatural stimuli. And one of the examples they give is that there are birds that will ignore eggs in favor of fake eggs, depending on the color that you make the fake egg. It will draw their attention and make them believe that's the more real, more important egg. And there's this red-bellied stickleback fish that will fight pieces of trash as if they were rivals, just because
they match the pattern.
Exactly.
And we have that too, right? We get tricked all the time by optical illusions.
Well, they put forth not just optical illusions, not just a visual thing. It's how we think. So humans also have the similar mistakes that people are pointing to, which is people have suggested that addictions like fast food or pornography are satisfying part of our matching system, which aren't necessarily giving us what we're expecting out of that experience.
Well, that does make sense. I mean, we talk sometimes about why you have a craving for sugar, for example, and it is because at one point in our life it was very important. So now we have that thing in our system, and it overrides us.
Yeah, and our decisions aren't making sense when you step back and actually look at it.
I grabbed a handful of M&Ms today, even though I do not eat sugar very often. I know, totally failed because the system worked better than my own judgment.
Don't look at me. I chose the Chex Mix.
I noticed that. I was impressed by you, sir. Finally. You want to do the last one? Or are we good for the...
Yeah, I'd love to, because it's been...
It's been a long time since you've had such a great lineup of stories, so I've been enjoying this quite a bit.
I got a working title.
Oh, that took a while.
Yeah. I got it while you guys were talking, so I just had to wait. Open.gov calls BS on 30-year-old Whopper AI.
Nice.
Nice.
I was thinking we really should move in the edit. I should go ahead and move the title of the show to the beginning of the show, don't you think?
How nonlinear of you.
Well, then it's like it makes sense that it's going to be, and it can sound like we had it all planned. It's genius. So should we introduce the show with that title?
Sure.
You ready to read it again? Wait. Are you ready? Episode 13 of season 17. I'm Lyle Troxell, and today's show...
Open.gov calls BS on 30-year-old Whopper AI.
Starts right now. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Dang, that's going to sound professional.
It is. It would have been better if I read it, but I like that Miles came up with it and read it. And then the question is, would I leave all this stuff at the end of the show or not? I don't know. But one last story from Mr. Brian Young, please. Tell us about liquid text. What is that?
I've been experimenting on myself these last two episodes, and it's been partially successful. So I've got a new app that I've been using for taking notes, for prepping for the show, for just reading through articles and trying to figure out what's important and set it aside.
And it's an iPad app.
This is an iPad app. Now, what's really interesting to me about this is I've been looking for iPad apps that are something that are, you know, really productive, really important, something you can't do with a computer, something you couldn't do with physical real-life objects, is something that really takes advantage of what an iPad is. And this is the first app that I can really point to that isn't just an extension of something I've used on the desktop. This is truly something that takes advantage of what the iPad's good for, allows me to do things that I was not doing on a computer. And the whole idea of this is that this was built around, it's kind of like the web. It was built around the idea of doing research. And the World Wide Web was invented because people wanted to, or Sir Berners-Lee wanted to, link research papers together and allow people to reference research papers.
Berners-Lee did not invent hypertexting, the concept of it. He implemented it, but
well, I mean, that was the problem he was solving with it.
Definitely.
So what this is it allows you to import web pages and PDFs and any other, several other kinds of documents. And as you're reading through it, you can highlight areas that are important that you want to take notes on.
Mm-hmm.
And what it does is it sends that highlighted section over to sort of an open clipboard or pegboard over to the side of what you're reading. And those become, you can think of them as note cards up on a pinboard.
Cool.
And you can connect those notes. You can kind of think of it like a, I'm forgetting the
like
name.
Like Play-Doh kind of? Like they kind of push together? And that's what I noticed the interface had kind of a, you could push them together.
Well, what are the, I want to say outliner, but there's
a brain map.
Yes, mappers, brain maps. There's another name for them as well, where you draw lines between thoughts and ideas and make your notes and graph them out that way. Well, this facilitates that by you can take two of these, I'll call them cards, move them close to each other, and they get this little liquid effect that connects the two. And you can easily show what ideas are connected. And so you can take some long web article or research paper or anything else that you're going through and start connecting ideas over on the side of it.
Which is cool because sometimes you want to get a pull quote or you want to make sure to remember somebody's name, so you put that at the top and kind of constructing more about how you want to take notes and discuss it. By the way, mind map is the word we're looking for,
Thank
right?
Thank you.
Yes.
You got it. So when I notice when a lot of reporters are writing their articles, they're trying to make an engaging article, and they're not relaying the information in any sort of way. Efficient way. They're not trying to just teach the material. They're trying to engage you and lead you through a story. So I often want to reorganize how they're talking about it so I can easily bring this up on the radio. And that's what this has been helping me for. But it's not just for like single articles. What's really impressive is you can throw in 3 or 4 or 5 articles and have those displayed next to all of your notes and intermix the notes between them.
Cool.
And
so this app, this app is called Liquid Text.
Right.
And it's an iPad only app.
Yeah.
Okay.
So for me, this is something that I kind of halfway dreamed up over the past couple of years, but now somebody's actually realized it. And
is it good? Is it reliable? Is it
okay, here's the thing. This thing, I consider it really revolutionary. This is a great idea, and it completely buggy as all get out.
Oh, no.
In fact, they allow you to use drawing with the iPad Pro Pencil as well, but I don't recommend doing that. It's been crashing on me constantly, and I'm losing 5 minutes of work.
You're spending hours and hours trying to use the more efficient system. You know, so, there's paper and pencils. Brian.
No, but this is the point, though. This is something you can't simply do with paper and pencil. Every one of these cards, it links right back to the article. It'll zip you right back within context of what that idea was. So,
All right. So
these are things you're not going to do that with a paper. You're not going to be able to take a linear form of information and make it non-linear just because it's not in the computer.
Now, that's true. That's true.
So I really like the concept of this thing. And the only reason why I am talking about it is because it, despite all of its flaws, this is something that I think is really helpful. And so I want to see it develop further. I want to see somebody take this to the point where maybe this becomes a OS level interaction with text and images.
You know, I think that they'd have to nail it a little bit better than the way they've done it right now to make it an OS level thing. But you're right that it's a different type of interface, a different way of thinking about content, about text content, than has ever been done before. And if you get efficient in it, it's probably a really good way of going. And I imagine there's going to be more and more of those new ways of manipulating content.
Right.
I think of the tools that I use right now for image editing online are all Photoshop based, and that methodology of what Photoshop does has just been spread to every single app out there, right? The language has stayed kind of constant instead of evolving over time to be different. there are samples of that. I mean, I'm thinking of like Instagram, for example. Instagram just has a whole bunch of presets, which are basically like a whole bunch of filters of Photoshop, but set in the one-click button thing. But in no way is there kind of the more loose quality or other ways of doing it you could imagine there could be. And as developers, you and I, and maybe Miles too, though I don't know if he ever thinks about UI, the experience of being frustrated by the current application state of how it can do things, even though you know it could be a lot better, is a very challenging place to be in. And I think of audio editing, because of course I edit the show every week, and the tools are just really bad compared to how they could be. And there are some examples of things that are potential, you know, have the interesting ideas. An iPad app that I use sometimes.
Ferrite?
Ferrite. I have used it a bit. It's just that it's not – there's one of those things that's tricky when you want to think of your consistent data file and a long-term preservation. I think of all the episodes we do of GeekSpeak as something that I want to keep for a long time. So I want the raw files and I want them available, and I also want to be able to edit them, and then I want to archive them. And I know that that application is very locked up in the iOS infrastructure. So in 10 years, I probably won't be able to open that app. If I keep the current laptop I have, in 10 years, I will be able to run Adobe Audition.
Right.
Right, because the application, it's not going
to
be...
Yeah, the chance of the iPad that you would try to keep this on, being able to run that app, the chance of that app being developed throughout the many iterations of the operating system that you would probably put on it is a lot, lot lower.
But the Audition format, because it's such a popular format, even if Audition no longer is available, probably years from now I'll be able to still read the file format and use it to some degree. At the same time, that's probably not that important. So, you know, after I edit it, when have I ever gone back to a show? I never do. So it's not necessarily an important thing, but it is one of those things that makes me feel a little... haphazard about being, you know, like that. The file, if you spend a lot of time editing those, that balloon file kind of thing, it's not going to be usable at some point. So how much time do you want to invest in it?
If other people don't use this app and the developer doesn't develop it further, I will
lose. So Brian suggests you use it right now. It's called Liquid Text, and share it with all your friends.
So I'll lose it all. But I can output these as PDFs
right,
unto
course.
Itself.
Yeah.
As well.
As, and of course, this shows we can export the final
right,
file.
But that's not the same thing.
No, it's not.
But I mean, we've had a touch interface in common use for about 10 years now.
Yeah.
Of course, it started on smaller devices. But the idea of using this completely different interface, I'm still so much more productive with a keyboard and a mouse on anything that feels like serious work. But this is the first time that I can't do this as fast and as...
the thing you're doing on this Liquid Text thing, you cannot do on a laptop.
I can't do it on a laptop as fast, as efficiently, as intuitively. Because, you know, I've started taking notes with a pen and pencil again, mm-hmm. instead of with a keyboard, because I realize that the part of my brain that is writing is able to put those thoughts down on paper is not as encumbered by listening to somebody speak as it is when I'm trying to type and manipulate a computer.
I know what you mean. Because you can't be rough and loose in your concepts in typing.
Right. They start to not make sense.
The whole point of like being a hand gesture of movement is that, you know, you can write a word kind of representational. You can also move slightly down to the right to represent that it's connected, right? And not have a structured way of doing that. And you can't do that the same way in a keyboard. I agree, it's the way we think about data. Miles, are you still here?
Yeah.
What are you working on?
Just doing some web code.
Yeah. All right. Bye, guys.